Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues and partners to discuss the market and macro environment along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. So joining us today here in our 1285 podcast studio in New York, glad to welcome back from our partners at First Eagle Investment Management, Matt McLennan, the co-head of the Global Value Team and Portfolio Manager. I believe, Matt, your second studio appearance with us here. You've been on with us many times prior. To my right today, we have, as always, Jason Dreho, the Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. So, Matt, Jason, it's great that we're all here today at the table. Welcome back and looking forward to hearing your thinking.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Matt. And for our listeners, it's cold in the studio, so if I start to chatter, that's where it's going from.
Hence the quarter zit, not that our listeners can see that. Yep. We do have a lot to cover on the podcast today, maybe a good starting point. And I will say up front, we are recording on Wednesday, April 17th, to give a bit of context as to when we're having this conversation. Though, Matt, of course, we have to acknowledge what an eventful past couple of weeks it has been in the markets, thinking about an abundance of macro data releases, some of which surprising to the upside, such as the March CPI print, rising geopolitical tensions. So a lot in the mix, though. How have these factors been impacting your macroeconomic outlook here in the U.S.?
So the markets, in a way, have behaved, I think, a little more rationally in the last couple of weeks, in the sense that there was a window where a little bit, perhaps, too much hot air had been pumped into the balloon in the lead up to this adjustment in prices and credit spreads in the markets. We saw a very meaningful easing of financial conditions. The market was essentially pricing a soft landing against the narrative economics, to use Shiller's term, of AI and all of these other sources of enthusiasm, when we hadn't really yet seen a landing in the economy. The labor markets remained pretty tight. And so the easing of financial conditions that we saw, credit spreads coming down, trading breadth widening, implied volatility in S&P 500 options, all of that led to an increase in debt issuance and M&A revenues and the like. Has those easier financial conditions have probably driven this recent uptick that you referenced, Dan, in terms of inflation print, retail sales, and the like. And this puts the Fed in a sort of a difficult situation, because not only did we have the hopes for a soft landing, we were coming into this with pretty strong nominal activity or drift, if you will, in the economy. Big budget deficits, wage growth above 5%, all of these things propelling nominal earnings growth at the same time that you had an easing of financial conditions. If I stand back from what's happened in the recent few weeks, what I would say is that we'd expect the hot air to gradually seep out of the balloon, if you will, over the coming 12 to 18 months. The Fed's interest rate now is actually above wage inflation. Wage inflation has moderated, as we've seen some signs of softening in the labor market. Job openings are softer. Full-time employment is softer. And wage growth, looking at the Atlanta wage tracker, is down to 4.7% now. So it's below the 5%. Meanwhile, the Fed's policy rate is above that. And if wage growth continues to drift lower, that gap will grow. And we haven't really seen that since the 2007-2006 type environment, which preceded some banking issues. We don't expect necessarily the same banking issues, but we are seeing, at least in the bank reports that we've seen, some pressure on net interest income, some pickup in delinquency rates, some slowing in loan growth. And so it feels to us that the nominal growth backdrop is slowing at the margin. And bottom up, we see that luxury goods sales are softening. Trucking activity has been a little soft. We think that this moment of exuberance may be a little behind us until we get concrete signs that there is an output gap in the economy, that the labor market is below its potential, not above.
You're talking about nominal activity has been elevated. I kind of think of it as like the 6% economy.
Yep.
If you add up kind of real GDP and inflation for the past 3 years, it's been over 6%. And we don't have Q1 GDP yet. The tracking estimates are close to 3 for real. We know inflation will be over 3, just based on sort of CPI. Rough calculation, we're like at a 6% nominal GDP. We expect that to slow. I mean, it hasn't thus far, at least not to the extent. But I want to kind of pick up on a point that you talked about, a little bit of frothiness. I mean, frothiness is probably not the right kind of word, but certainly things have held up better than expected for the past couple of quarters, and we've had easier financial conditions. And one of the things that, as we think about it over the past couple of years, is the Fed has raised rates. The expectation is they're going to raise rates, especially when they're aggressive, like this will trigger a recession, right? The consensus view, pretty strong consensus 12 months ago, especially after Silicon Valley Bank went under, was we will have a recession that begins in the second half of 23. Instead, we had 4% GDP growth in the second half. So kind of tear up those economic models and let's kind of think about things differently. One of the things is kind of how to think about monetary policy and whether it's restrictive or not. And there's almost, you know, kind of not two different views, but like there's a view of like policy rates operate with a long and variable lag. And you cited some of the data where now the policy rate 5.5% higher than wage growth. This should start to bite. At the same time, there's financial conditions that people didn't really talk about pre-GFC, but now it's become all easier financial conditions. Things kind of ease up there. And certainly since October low when the 10-year was at 5%, the S&P is up 20-25% since then. Really significant easing in financial conditions. It can become self-referential because higher stock prices are easier financial conditions. That's good for the economy. Therefore, it's higher stock prices. Like that's a little bit of circular logic. But sort of between the two does feel like sometimes, I'm not accusing you of this, but like people can sort of say, oh, well, easier financial conditions, therefore the economy is doing well, as opposed to a year ago, they would have saying, well, higher rates are going to bite. So it's a little bit of eye sometimes when like, which is it? Can it be the same things simultaneously? So how would you kind of think about monetary policy, given what's happened, given how the markets have responded to certainly a little more dovish commentary last fall and even into the spring, the Fed, still you could say, like, especially the March meeting was kind of dovish.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that we still have an imperfect understanding of how monetary policy works. And this is nothing new. What's interesting to me is how poor a job the long end of the bond market has done at predicting the interest rate trend in the economy. So we had a period from the early to mid-60s to the early 80s where there were cyclical variations in interest rates, but there was a structural uptrend. And then we had a 40-year period from the early 80s to the to 2020 where there was a structural downtrend. And so the long end of the curve was kind of getting it wrong persistently, which provides some evidence of the notion that there may be a what's sort of referred to as an autocorrelative or a self-referencing process at work here. And I think one of the things that happens that makes trying to assess monetary policy very complex is that when you have higher interest rates, over time, that adds to the budgetary deficit pressures, and it sort of augments, if you will, the pace of monetary creation in the economy. Larger deficits essentially creating a higher sort of high watermark, if you will, in terms of the nominal economy. And so, we've had a situation the last few years where we've seen not just a breakout on the upside in terms of interest rate trends, but it's happened at a time where the primary deficit has been about 3% of GDP, adjusting for where we are in the cycle. And what I mean by the primary deficit is the budget deficit before interest expense. So in much of the post-war period, from World War II through to 2000, the primary account of the government was pretty much in balance with some cyclical fluctuations. But we now have this deficit. And so going back to your 6% economy, we had not only sort of close to 6% wage growth, but we had 6% budget deficits when the debt to GDP was close to 100%. So we're growing the stock of government debt at around about a 6% clip. So that whole nominal high watermark was growing. And, so I think, and then you have the prospect as you roll the government stock of debt, the average interest on the government's debt today is just over 3%. It's going to roll to a higher level, which adds to those deficits. It adds to that nominal drift. And so I think there is an element of interest rate trends being a little bit self-perpetuating through the fiscal channel. Having said that, I think if interest rates get extreme relative to that trend level, then they can retard or assist nominal activity. And so we're in a situation now where it would appear that maybe rates are going to be higher than people thought they would be for longer than people thought. At some point, if that bites, they'll end up being lower than people thought and perhaps more quickly than people think. But you know, when we come out the other side, it could be that to the extent that we've broken out on the upside from a 40-year downtrend in rates, that, you know, we're going to be cycling around a gradually rising rate level over time. So a key sort of thought I want to leave you with here is maybe 2020 and 2021 were a generational low in the cost of capital. And we're sort of going through a little bit of a seismic shift here in terms of shifting to a higher cost of capital, a higher rate of nominal drift in the economy, to use your 6% term. And I think the fiscal channel is the key thing that's helping to explain this.
Well, it's hard to think of cheaper cost of capital than in 2020 when the 10-year got to 60 basis points and there was $17 trillion debt worldwide that had negative yields. I don't think that's probably... in our lifetimes, one maybe hope that that's probably like the peak. I want to kind of just pick up this idea of you know, you described how bond yields rose in the 60s, 70s, peaked in the early 80s, and then we're on a 40-year decline. And the bond market at the long end was always a little bit behind. There's an element where you could always say, like, you're kind of driving by looking at the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And certainly for the past couple of years, I'd say up until like even the last 6 months or so, there's been a view that in some way we might return to the 2010s of this post-GFC, pre-pandemic kind of secular stagnation, lower for longer regime. Now, for a variety of reasons, some of it's fiscal, and there's other factors going on that's maybe no longer the right regime.
Yeah.
And so when I look at, if we leave out fiscal for the moment, just think about the bond market. There's certainly people who claim that the Fed has kind of lost credibility, the lost inflation battle. I look at the market pricing for break-even inflation. It's been pretty flat, you know, for the past 3 years since inflation really started to surge. What's changed is the market pricing for the neutral rate. And if you plot that, it's gone up, you know, from less than 2% back in 3 years ago. Now it's around 4%. It doesn't account for the entire rise in the 10-year yield, but it explains a lot of the rise. So to me, when I kind of look at that, it's the market's rising. The Fed, if they want inflation under control, they can get inflation under control. But our assessment of how much the economy can grow, whether because of fiscal or just more productivity, whatever it might be, is higher than we assume. This gets into like the 6%. I'm kind of assuming 3% real, 3% inflation as opposed to 2 and 2 that it was pre-pandemic. Now, I'm in the optimistic camp of like a structural kind of roaring 20s possibility for the economy just growing faster for a variety of reasons. But it does feel like, whether you believe that or not, the market is, investors are kind of coming around to like that 2010s was the anomaly. We're going to a rate environment that maybe is more consistent with like the pre-GFC or the 1990s level. So like, and whether it's drifting higher, but it definitely kind of level shifts higher, and then how it kind of goes from there, that's to be determined. So I think we're kind of maybe in agreement with that. But as thinking from the investment implications, you know, outside of fixed income, because you'd have to play that in certain ways with the curve and where you want to be exposed, but thinking about maybe equity markets, if that's the equity, if we're in a 6% nominal GDP growth environment going forward, you know, and picking that as sort of as a baseline, how does that sort of change your thinking and, like, you know, whether it's drive more for inflation, real GDP, productivity growth, whatever it is, like, what does that mean for, you know, investing overall in that kind of situation?
Sure. First, I think there's some risk that we're decelerating from the 6% level. You know, once we get through this this window of sort of uptick in behavior, just because at the margin, fiscal deficits are starting to contract. The deficits are occurring on a larger stock of debt, so the nominal inflation of the stock of debt is moderating just by virtue of the stock being larger relative to the deficit. And as I mentioned, some of the bank lending activity is showing signs of abating. But, you know, these things are notoriously difficult to predict. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we try to dimension in our mind is, you know, are we in a 1990s environment or are we in a 1970s environment? And that has big implications for, you know, what does well over the next decade. Because the lead into the 1970s was a period of very weak or easy fiscal policy with the Vietnam War. It was also a moment of geopolitical risk, and obviously, you know, we're in one of those moments. And I think whether it's the tensions with China or the Russia-Ukraine war or what's going on in the Middle East, these things tend to lead to a slower rate of kind of globalization, less efficient trade patterns. Those are sort of headwinds to productivity growth. And, you know, we're also, I guess, if I look region by region in a window where the state is growing in importance, where the pace of regulation across different dimensions, depending on the economy you're in, has been going up. And we sort of view that as a kind of a productivity question mark. And I think the 1970s were that period where you had the confluence of geopolitical, fiscal, and productivity headwinds. And so we certainly hope we're not going into that environment, but it's something to be mindful of. And when I think of the equity market more specifically...
Actually, before you get that, thinking this is simplistic, but if you think 70s or 1990s, do you have a leaning which way it is? And if you say like, you know, 50-50, 60-40, and everything is in history, you know, rhymes, it doesn't repeat. So there's going to be elements clearly of the 1970s. There's certainly elements that look like the 1990s right now, just from a technology perspective. So how would you sort of like, you know, cherry pick and sort of, you know, piece together?
I'm probably leaning more towards the 70s for the simple reason that a defining feature of the 1970s was the breakdown of the Bretton Woods Agreement. So essentially what had been the sort of de facto currency and reserve structure of the world broke down, and you had a kind of a window of kind of perceptual dislocation in fixed income and markets and inflation expectations. And I guess the tipping point for me in terms of trying to make that judgment, and I acknowledge there's a huge ambiguity around these things and the crystal ball is foggy at best, but I think we've seen a break in the currency regime. And it doesn't sort of show up in an obvious way in the sense that the dollar is still being strong. But when Russia invaded the Ukraine, we sanctioned Russians' ability to access their reserves. And if you think of how the geopolitical landscape has evolved since then, there's been this kind of the emergence of what I would call the sort of de facto heartland alliance or access between, you know, extending from North Korea to China to Russia, Iran. Countries like Russia and in particular China were very important reserve accumulators of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. runs quite a large current account deficit. It needs to attract foreign reserve buyers, and an important constituency of the treasury market is arguably stepping aside. In addition to which, you know, we've got the Fed shrinking its balance sheet. We've got regional banks unable to really go out and buy a lot of long-dated sovereign debt. And so I think what's been interesting to me is that if I think of market price action in the year to date, we've seen both gold and equities make a new high, and to me that tells me that the real value of money is going down. And in fact, if you look at the price of gold relative to a long dated index fund for treasuries, so just to pick one, the 20-year plus iShares, if you look at the ratio of gold to that ETF, at the time of the Russian invasion, the two started to decouple. They traded pretty much on top of each other for 5 or 6 years. While treasuries have gone down, in normal terms, gold has held and actually increased in nominal value. And so the ratio has expanded. Gold has more than doubled its value relative to long-term treasuries. And we've seen central bank buying change. And so I think we are at a kind of... a delicate inflection point with the underlying financial architecture of the world, as we were in the early 1970s. And so that might tip me slightly in thinking that there's more unanticipated change to come.
I mean, the relationship of gold versus rates, commodities versus the dollar this year have not behaved the way you think. Typically, because commodities are priced in dollars, stronger dollar, commodity prices should go down. They've actually gone up. Gold, with high real rates, you'd think they would go lower. It's gone the other direction. So it is... You know, you wonder, is this a dislocation or is a disruption to a regime? The one thing that I don't have a good answer to this, but thinking about in terms of, you know, the U.S. instead of the dollar, a lot of people think like people could take their money out, they could withdraw treasuries. But the one thing that's become, feels like increasingly clear is that the one place in the world where you can buy risk assets and roll by risk assets in scale is the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that dominance is not getting weaker, it's getting stronger. When I look at Europe, you think about kind of the growth opportunities. You have companies in Europe wanting to list in the U.S. You still have Chinese companies that would want to list in the U.S., but you know may not be able to for regulatory reasons. And it's the biggest, deepest liquid financial market. That like this becomes, until something happens, the environment. So one of the arguments that people have been making for 5 or more years why the dollar could depreciate is that investors seem like they're overweight U.S. assets. But I also ask, well, if you're looking for growth in an environment where it may be challenged to get growth globally, where else are you going to kind of get it, right? And until there's some change in that, and you know, that can happen at any point in time, it feels like it's a little bit of, you know, the argument for the U.S., you know, was it, I don't know if it was not John Lindsay, but like the finance minister, the treasury secretary for Nixon, of like, it's our dollar, but it's your problem. You know, it's like a little bit like, you know, too bad. Like, you want growth, you have no choice but to come and get it. And it sort of self-perpetuates in a way that, like, that's where the growth opportunities are. It's a idea I'm kind of thinking about, but there is some sort of structural aspect that feels like that's a first mover advantage that's really, really hard to displace. Yeah. And so therefore the U.S. economy versus other regions has a structural advantage that will, that could persist in ways that, how do you factor that into the whole macro dynamic? And you know, it's something that maybe didn't exist in the 1970s.
No, it's an interesting, the U.S. was, I guess, the key attractor for capital, you know, even under the Bretton Woods system. But, you know, I think what's kind of interesting here, if we sort of think about equity markets in the context of this backdrop that you paint, is that we've basically seen equity multiples move up at a time where interest rates are moving up. So in a sense, you could make the argument that the implied risk premiums come down quite a bit, and arguably more than the reduction in credit spreads that we've seen in high yield markets. And so, you know, one of the questions I'm grappling with in my mind is, are we at a moment like we were in 87, where you saw the bond market sell off and you saw equities rally, and then we saw a very sharp adjustment in equity prices? Or are we in a moment where there's a kind of a recognition that many of the equities that are out there are more like real assets as opposed to nominal assets, thus peaking at the same time as gold? And in fact, if you look at the value of U.S. equity market and the value of gold, even though they've decoupled from interest rates, they've tracked pretty neatly the growth in the stock of government debt outstanding. And so they've tracked the high water nominal mark of the economy. And so... And we've seen that in extremists in places like India over a sustained period of time, where in India you have this strange situation where you have the confluence of high interest rates and high multiples. And I think, you know, if I try to reconcile this in my mind, it comes back to the fiscal picture where when you run large primary deficits and you're running large fiscal deficits, which is the case in India as it is in the case in the United States, not only do you get high nominal drift in the economy, your 6% example, but interest rates over time tend to clear at levels below the rate of nominal drift. And so if you're trying to keep pace, if you're trying to preserve wealth in real terms relative to that nominal drift, then you have to sort of skew your asset allocation towards real assets that participate in that nominal drift. And you'll see in India, for example, cap rates on real estate are low, not high. And the multiples for consumer staples, for example, that are kind of low beta real participants in that nominal drift are extraordinarily high. And so, you know, we might have a strange situation here where the markets are bifurcating it a little bit, that we had a window where earnings yields and interest rates used to sort of trend together. But we might be more in a world, if there are these sort of structural fiscal issues, of people opting for real assets to preserve wealth. And so we won't know whether it's 87 or it's India. Time will tell. But I if I had to sort of weigh these different things, I'm probably skewing a little to the conservative side, because I think that ultimately measures of risk perception are below average in the economy. Credit spreads are still below average, slightly, even though they've backed up a little bit recently. Implied volatility's backed up recently, but before that had been quite below average, and trading breadth had been quite broad relative to average. And so, I think the market feels to me that it's been pricing not just the fact that these are real assets, but that we're going to have a soft landing, and given we don't know exactly what's going to play out, and arguably policy's moved into a more restrictive space, I guess I'm a little more prudent in terms of my feeling of the risk reward, but I do think we have to be open minded to the fact that there are regimes out there that have shown high interest rates and high multiples.
So I'll make 3 points and ask you some questions about investing, because this is interesting, but like ultimately we have to make decisions of where to put capital. One is, the point about large deficits, and that could be fueling things. When I look at U.S. S&P 500, the equities, you look at the Magnificent Seven and then everything else and their earnings growth. Fantastic for the seven, basically flat for a year, year and a half. Small caps, I think it's really no earnings growth for 18 months, which... it's not a perfect explanation, but like, if you think this fiscal should matter for the U.S. economy, it should be benefiting not just those seven companies. And those seven companies are secular growth stories that benefit from a global story. So to me, that can't be a fiscal story. I mean, that there's an element, maybe be worse if there wasn't more fiscal, but clearly how it's done is something that's more of a micro level story, so as opposed to macro. That'd be one thing. The second point, I absolutely agree with the idea that certainly the long-term equities have proven to be kind of real assets, you know, because companies can pass on costs, they can adjust it. Whereas bonds, you know, if you buy a bond with a certain yield and the inflation goes up, you will just lose value if you hold that over time. What's interesting is that perhaps the market's thinking, treating equities as real sooner than it would have otherwise. And just thinking about like companies, I think like Pepsi is an example. They were reporting at different quarters last year, like earnings growth of 9%, but 10% was price increase and like volume actually declined 1%. So they were basically able to pass the price on entirely. So like in real time, they were literally sort of like saying, we are a real asset, our volumes don't change, but we're going to be completely marking to market. And if that's the case, then your point about like high valuations and higher rates actually for equities, that can make sense. Leads to the third point, which the hard part of sort of doing that is, you know, history tells you like valuations tend to mean reverted. You want to say this time is different. To make that call, you're definitely kind of going on in a bit of a leap to say like, we are in a new regime, which in hindsight, you know, might be proven correct. But in real time, it's really hard to know whether this is dislocations or it's overpriced or mispriced or it's actually something different. So it makes investment decisions like you kind of err towards, you want to think this, but if I'm wrong, then I could be really wrong versus if I stayed true, at least I could sort of, you know, kind of falling back on it. So given all that, when you think about, just say within equities, how are you thinking, because I know you're not necessarily investing like the next 3 or 6 months, but more like 18, 24 months, or even long term, how are you thinking about that in terms of the kind of things you'd want to invest in, where you want to invest, size, style, sectors, however you want to kind of break it down?
So the risk in equities is that, you know, are we, if one enters a sort of a structurally higher rate of nominal drift in the economy, like the 70s, that hasn't always been propitious for valuations. That sometimes the perception of monetary disorder flows through to a higher risk premium. So, you know, we entered the 1970s at close to 20 times earnings, and we exited at close to 10 times earnings. If the perception is that we've kind of lost a monetary rudder, then it's conceivable that equities face derating risk. What's interesting to me in India, that many of the companies that trade at super premium valuations aren't those that have the highest rates of earnings growth necessarily. They're the kind of government bond substitutes. They're the low beta resilient staples. And I think one of the interesting ways to kind of navigate markets today, if I look at, you know, where our portfolio has gone bottom up, is that we actually, aside from having a potential hedge in gold, we have our highest weighting in staples that we've had for quite some time, because the market has been very enthusiastically pricing the perception of excess, sustainable excess growth. If we look at the ratio of valuation of the growth sector to the value sector of the markets, it's as stretched as it was in the late 90s. And what we do know, even though we don't know when it will occur, is that every growth company today will one day be a value company. When its business matures, it faces more competitive pressures or sort of substitutes. So I think one of the areas where we've traditionally seen premium valuations, and we certainly see it in the Indian market, that we don't see premium valuations today is in the staples universe. These are particularly outside the United States, some of the European companies where we see sort of 6-ish% free cash flow yields, the ability to sort of capture inflation over time, and beta characteristics that are quite modest. And so if you're uncertain about whether we're sort of transitioning to a higher rate of nominal drift and you want companies that can capture that, or it's a window of temporary exuberance and there's, you know, downside risk in the markets like the mid-80s that I referenced before, or other sort of environments that turned out to be recessionary that people didn't think would be recessionary, then I think, you know, staples could offer you prospective resilience in either one of those scenarios. And the market's really derated these companies, over the last couple of years. And so that's one area that I would sort of highlight as counterintuitively having sort of bubbled to the top, you know, on a company by company basis in our portfolios.
So it's a little bit like they're real defensive assets to some extent.
Yeah, you know, that's right. Different,
you know, interesting. Yeah. Anything else in particular that you kind of like right now?
Within the context of the equity markets, I would also say that we if I look at our weightings, I think one of the things that's quite stark is that technology was a very large sector for us. It's more modest now, just given the valuation expansion that we've seen there. And I think what that's meant is that our weighting to international equities is more than where the indices are at the moment. And you know, the U.S. market, by virtue of its resilience, is trading at roughly 20 times earnings, 5% earnings yield. You know, we're seeing closer to 7% yields internationally. And in some markets, in the emerging markets space in particular, closer to 10% earnings yields. And so the arithmetic gap in earnings yields is starting to get wide relative to the growth differential that's actually been achieved over the last 20 years. And same could be said between value and growth, that the actual growth differential in sales per share and earnings per share between those two universes has only been a couple of percentage points over the last 20 years. But the earnings yield gap now is close to 4%. And so it may be that we go into a sort of a strange environment where people have to weigh arithmetic. That the kind of valuation shift has been quite distinct. And so, when I think about the Staples comment that I made before, many of these are international, as I mentioned earlier. I guess I would say as well that, when we look at our portfolio bottom up, and it's, I don't want to overgeneralize about themes here, but there are disconnects that we see in how risk is being priced. So for example, one of the risks that market participants are very focused on right now is China.
Value market, if there ever was one.
But that risk is not being priced equally. So, for example, if you look at Hong Kong-listed property holding companies, they trade at a fraction of the private market value of their assets, and you're getting a return off capital because of the dividend stream on those companies. On the other hand, there are American companies that totally depend on China for their supply chain that aren't reflecting any discount at all. And so, I guess sometimes in investing, you end up with a kind of barbell of sorts. And so we've dipped our toe in the water on some names, either in Hong Kong or even in China. It's a small percentage of our portfolio. We own more gold as a potential hedge than we own in those investments. But all I can say is that risk is being priced differently in those markets from how it's being priced in the U.S. market.
So there's almost an arbitrage of political risk premium. Low in the U.S., really high for some of those assets.
It's true. And in fact, if what you're trying to do is position yourself for a world that could be geopolitically bifurcated for longer, if you think about what that means, it means there's going to be an element of kind of manufacturing re-onshoring at some point. That's got to be automated. The repository of most factory automation technologies in Japan, Japanese companies, because they went through that process last, basically, prior to China. And so, there are companies that are interesting in Japan, if that's your scenario, medium term. And the irony of a lot of these things as well is that sectors like energy could be beneficiaries either of growth in AI and growth in the cloud and the energy demands of that, but they could also be beneficiaries of higher geopolitical risk premia. And they certainly provided that role in the 1970s.
When I think about, certainly for our clients, and this is probably true for U.S. investors in general, strong home bias, maybe not quite as biased as in other markets where it's a really small percentage of the global pie, but still been a reluctance given the performance to kind of look abroad. But in a world where what looks like it would become at least dislocating, but moving in different directions or sort of decoupling to some extent, maybe that's a better way to think of it than deglobalization. There'll be different winners and losers. And it's also from a diversification perspective, it's almost like playing for a position for different macroeconomic geopolitical scenarios playing out in that regards. I know we're probably coming up to time here.
Well, I know the conversation could continue. That means, Matt, we'll have to have you back as we see how conditions evolve in the months ahead. But I do want to thank you both for spending the time that you did today with our listeners, our clients of UBS, and for your guidance thoughts when it comes to positioning. So thank you both again, Matt and Jason.
Thank you, Matt, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And again, today we've been joined by Matt McLennan of First Eagle Investment Management, as well as Jason Dreho from the UBS Chief Investment Office. This has been another episode of How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel from UBS Studios. I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.